So thanks for joining us for the Road to Gold Q&A session on the 26th of December, Boxing Day. At least it is for me, Andy Rice in Winchester, UK. But of course, for Hamish Wilcox in New Zealand, it's the morning of the 27th of December. So Hamish, tell us, where are you today? What are you up to?
Good morning, everybody. Yeah, we've got a couple of days off from the Cup stuff, and we've left in our boat Adamite, and we're currently down in Kauau Island, which is about 25 miles north of Auckland. And we're just waiting for this Q&A because we needed internet, and this is the last bit of internet we'll have for our week of sailing because we're heading out to Barrier today where there isn't any internet. In fact, there's no electricity either.
Right. So you better get your questions in now because we haven't got Hamish for the next few days. So you better make the most of him. Now, Hamish, let's see if we can get you to do a quick 360 with the iPad. Just give us an idea of where you are and just make us even more envious.
Okay. Well, it's the sun's coming up here. And I'm not sure if you can see where we are, but this is the bay, and everybody's stacked up here because they're all leaving to go north. And this is the first stop on your way up to the Bay of Islands. So, yeah, you see the boats are starting to head out now, a couple on the way out there. But, yeah, this is Kauau Bay looking across to Algies Bay. And that's it.
Yeah, well, that's quite a view. So I hate to have to break you away from the holiday like this. It's really, I feel bad for you, Hamish. But anyway, we'll only keep you for an hour and then you can be on your way up to Great Barrier where there's no electricity and no internet. Now, just update us with what more you know about the America's Cup, because when we spoke to you exactly a week ago, we just completed some racing, but then there was going to be a Christmas race the following day. Anyway, what's happened in the last week? What do you know as of the last week in the America's Cup?
I think everybody's, you know, the overall feedback from the regatta was amazing. You know, the boats look incredible up close. They are racing. There's a lot of lead changes, and the racing's exciting to watch on that short course format. It's incredible to think that the boats are sort of four times faster than the version 5 boats, and yet we're racing on a course that's half the size as the old boats. So you can imagine the containment and that the level of intensity must be, you know, a portion of like 10 times more intense on those boats than it was on the old America's Cup boats that were in Auckland, you know, 20 years ago. So yeah, it's a big change, and I thought it was a great success.
Now, we saw a picture of you on the boat, the only one without a crash helmet. So tell us, what were you doing on the boat and how come you didn't have a crash helmet?
Well, that's right. I'm on the chase boat that comes into the yacht. So whenever that we come alongside, we greet the yacht and we usually jump on and, you know, do some sail changes, have a chat. And typically, you know, the jibs comes down. And so to do that, we need to grind somebody up to release the halyard off the lock and then flake it on the deck and get ready for a possible jib change. And so normally I'm on the boat helping out, but at the same time, just being there to have a chat with the sailors on the boat and about the next race or about the race we've had.
Now, I saw that on Facebook, Ian Walker, who was skipper of GBR Challenge 20 years ago in Auckland and also has sailed in other America's Cups as well. He doesn't seem to be a big fan of this style of competition. It's all a bit too much about the muscle and not enough about some of the subtleties of sailing for him. I just wonder how you feel about this style of America's Cup compared with the ones that you've been involved with in the past.
I think it's an interesting thing. I think unless you were kind of involved in the game, it's hard to make a comment because I would say, you know, the subtleties of sailing are much greater than they've ever been, you know, including the catamarans. Even though these boats are a little bit heavier than the catamarans, they take a real finesse to try to get them to tack or jibe. And we could see that on the last day when we're marginal foiling. It was almost identical to sailing a moth or watching a moth regatta. You know, there's, you know, some boats were getting up and staying up, and some boats weren't even getting up, and some boats were, you know, getting up some of the time and not the rest of the time. And so the skill set required by everybody on board to make those boats tack or jibe or maneuver is right up there with anything you can do in a dinghy. And when I compare it to other America's Cup team, you know, I've been involved with, it's certainly a lot harder from a sailing perspective to manage these boats than it's been before. And I always think it comes down, you know, like I've said to you before, you know, the weight of the boat versus the weight of the crew kind of thing is, you know, becomes the sensitive point. And yeah, even though these boats are 6 tons, they've got a ton of crew on board. So, you know, it's a 6-to-1 ratio. In the old days, the boats were, you know, something like 23 tons, I think it was. And they must have had, probably a similar, maybe a little bit more than a couple of tons of crew. So the ratio was greater. And they weren't balancing on a foil. So I think, you know, to answer Ian's question, I think they're probably that more of a technically harder boat to sail and keep up on the foil and balance than the old days.
And so Nathan Outridge, who's part of the commentary team for the TV, and I always think, Nathan Outridge, what is he not doing on one of those team boats? He, for me, is one of the biggest picks, I would say. For seriously, guys, have you really got people that are better than Nathan Outridge on your team? I wouldn't necessarily say that for the Kiwis, but I look at some of the other teams. Anyway, we're lucky that the TV's got him instead. And Nathan has always been of the view that the moth sailors make the best foilers when you move up to large scale foiling, which sort of ties in with your theory that the longer that you spend away from small boats, the more that your senses become dulled as a sailor. I wonder how much you think that Pete Burling, and the fact that he's an ex-Moth World champion, how much that gives him an advantage over some of the other skippers like, say, Jimmy Spithill and Dean Barker and Ben Ainslie, some of whom have dabbled in moths, but they haven't won Moth World Championships. How much of a difference does that make?
I'm sure it makes a difference. You know, I remember, Lance Armstrong talking about getting back on the bike again. I know it's a dirty word at the moment, but, you know, he's a good example of someone who said, you know, quite honestly, you know, I've got a long, long way to go before my reaction time and skill set gets to where it needs to be to ride in the peloton like I used to. And I think that's the truth of it. You know, you lose stuff by the month. You know, you're as you say, you get dulled when you move out of a dinghy, and you know, your reaction time has to be absolutely precise or you're going to be swimming around the boat. So I agree with your comment there that those sailors that are more current and are more familiar with how the boats behave on a foil are going to be more comfortable than those that are learning to do it. So, you know, it's a bit like learning to sail a yacht and a keel boat, as opposed to learning to sail a boat in an Optimus or a smaller version, a dinghy, which you pay the price by capsizing.
And obviously we've got a special focus this week for our Q&A on boat handling, but just to remind everybody, you can always ask questions about any part of the Road to Gold, but this is about boat handling. And I just wonder, us armchair experts observing the America's Cup from the outside, we always tend to focus on the things that we can see, and that's the different shape of the foils when they're out of the water, or it's the sail shapes. What are we missing? What are we not seeing about the subtleties of boat handling on these boats?
Yeah, well, I think that's probably the question everybody's going to go away and ask. Certainly within our team, you know, we would have said that one of the biggest things that we left on the table was our manoeuvres around the course, our starting. And you saw people within the starting box make mistakes in all the teams. And, you know, only need to, you know, slightly fumble a manoeuvre and splash down a little bit, and suddenly your time on distance to the start is completely gone and you can never recover it, because whatever your machine's telling you is out the window. And and you're late. And it certainly happened to us half the time, and happened to other teams an equal amount of time, and it's very hard to manage. And it all comes back not to the machine, but to the sailors themselves, and doing those manoeuvres perfectly as the machine expects them to be done, and then arriving at the start line with the correct time. So yeah, boat handling is a big deal, and in these boats it's a really big deal. And I think there's a lot, a lot left for us and a lot left for the other teams in terms of perfecting their manoeuvres and going back to the basics and just getting the boats around the course. And you look at the amount of time that people have done sailing those boats, and it doesn't even equate to a decent optimist campaign going towards the nationals. You know, they're around 60 or 70 days, the most that any team's done down here in Auckland on those boats. And so it's certainly not going to get you a 10 out of 10 in boat handling, is it?
Yeah, and it reminds me what you say about when Terry Hutchinson, midway through the year, was asked, what do you think about your approach about being so focused on all this training that you're doing with your boat in Pensacola, Florida? And meanwhile, Ben Ainslie is off absolutely dominating the opening event of SailGP around this time last year in Sydney, a great morale booster. But Terry's comment was, well, that's great if Ben wants to do that. I don't know where he finds the time, because we haven't got time to do what we need to do. And it's an interesting question there as to where you divert your attention, whether going racing and absolutely dominating the way that Ben Ainslie did. I thought, fantastic. That's got to be a great morale booster. And of course, that doesn't mean that the reasons why Ineos are struggling now is because that they raced in the SailGP regatta. That would be a stupid conclusion to make. But it does take me back to what Terry said, that there's just not enough time to do everything that you need to do. And really, as you say, they're not really that far down the road to gold when you compare the kind of more mature campaigns that we look at in other parts of the sport.
Exactly. Yeah, I think you've summed it up pretty well. You know, we look at all the teams, it's a race against time, and it's a race against those 12 chapters. And, you know, one of the biggest chapters for them is the speed chapter. And they've been, focusing, as they should, 100% on performance. You can't, until you can go fast enough, it doesn't matter how good you are tactically. So they've got a lot of priority on that, which makes sense, but they've got to come back and polish up their boat handling and manoeuvres, and they've got to get racing.
Now, Alvaro has asked our first question in the chat box, and so we'll come to that in a moment. And that's a good reminder that, of course, you are very much encouraged to ask questions as much as possible. We've also got some questions that people have sent in advance of the call. And remember that you can always do that. That's ask Hamish at roadtogold.net. And so there are various ways of dealing with those questions. I also am always amazed at the quality of some of the people that come in on this call as well. It's often the case that the people who least need this kind of intelligence are also often the people that come in on this call. So we have, for example, Lily Zhu, the 2012 Olympic champion in the laser radial. And I hope she doesn't mind me mentioning, but I know that you're here to learn, Mael, but I see that we have Mael, and I'm thinking that's probably Mael Frascari, the 2019 world champion in the NACRA 17. So we've got some incredible caliber sailors. And if Mael cares to, yes, it is. So hi to you, Mael, and happy Christmas to you. And if there's anything that you want to come in and make an observation about, particularly at sort of high performance boat handling, because that no one's been through quite the sort of the level of learning that the NACRA 17s have been in over the last few years. The rate of development in that class must be absolutely incredible. So you're very welcome to put your hand up and make a comment. But of course, you are primarily here to learn as well, I guess. But let's try and make this as much of a two-way process, because Hamish would admit, like the rest of us, none of us, no individual has all the answers. So let's pitch in and share and help each other out as much as we can. I will address your question in a moment, Alvaro, but I thought a nice way into the whole boat handling thing. There's a couple of angles here, actually. One is chapter two and fitness and cross training. And Hamish, you're a big fan of cross training. You're also putting yourself at the bottom of the road to gold again with your new Christmas time pursuit of wing foiling. So tell us what it's like to go wing foiling, why you're doing it, and what it's like to be a beginner again.
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's you're very humbling. The it's a Christmas present. No, it's an early Christmas present. I've started about five times. I've been up now, and it's a hell of a lot of fun starting something new. And you know, I can feel most of the muscles in my body today after a couple of days of it. Yesterday and the day before, and it's been perfect conditions. We've had lots of wind from the southwest and lots of splashing and crashing, and yeah, certainly I haven't got to the point of turning the thing yet, but I'm quite fine going both directions now, so I'm pretty chuffed with my progress so far for an old fella.
Yeah, so closing on 60 in a bit less than a year, so good going, as anyone would know who's been through your chapter two fitness program. Pretty impressive. You're very much about always learning new things, learning new skills. And one of the things that stands out to me at the beginning of our recorded sessions in chapter three, looking at boat handling, is you believe that you described it as a tick off. It's not something that requires any special talent to get good at boat handling, even to world class level. It's just something that you apply yourself to. And anybody can learn those boat handling skills. And to me, that wasn't an obvious point. And I don't know if anyone else wants to comment on that, but why is it that so many of us never get to that level in our boat handling if it's that straightforward to do it?
Yeah, and I think it's a really good point. And you know, those things, those chapters in the Road to the Gold that you can just apply yourself and with, you know, a reasonably good program and a huge amount of dedication. You know, they're givens, and you might as well take them because there's a lot of things ahead that are hard and require a lot more patience and a lot more, you know, technology, if you like, and a lot more development. So, you know, the boat handling is one that you don't want to leave on the table, if you like. And I think, I think Pete and Blair are a classic example, you know, But their boat handling is the best in the fleet across all conditions, and it gets them out of trouble in so many ways. You can fall back on your boat handling in order to be able to make better decisions. You know, you can if you know you can tack in a certain place because you're so good at tacking, you'll be able to do it, and that allows you to make that decision. And it's the same coming off the start line. If you've got the ability to maneuver your boat well, you'll often end up at the front row. And if you're up the ability to accelerate well, you'll again, it'll help you towards that front row start. And if you don't make that perfect start because something's gone wrong with your timing, you know, you've still got the fallback on your ability to tack and find your way into a clear lane. So boat handling develops you into our next chapter, and it develops you into racing well, you know, making good decisions and everything else. So you actually fundamentally have to have perfect boat handling before you sort of venture into the rest of it, because you know, as we've seen in the America's Cup, if you can't go around the course, you know, you're not going to finish the race.
I remember congratulating Pete and Blair just after they won the gold medal in Rio, and I was interviewing them and I was speaking to Blair, and I had a bit of a joke with Blair about how they had a slight fluff of one of their takedowns, one of their drops at the leeward gate, which didn't quite go to plan. And I had a bit of a dig at him, and it didn't quite land right. He didn't quite see the humour in what I was saying. And he said, well, you wouldn't see anybody else try what we did just then. So I sort of touched on a nerve there, and he didn't take kindly to that. And I thought, wow, that was quite revealing in that he really takes massive pride in just how they get the kite, you know, half a boat length down later than anybody else. And they're already winning the regatta by a country mile. It's not like they had to do that maneuver as precisely as they tried to do it, and it didn't quite work out for them. But we all understand that that boat handling is great to get, but what is it about that attitude and approach to learning that sets them apart?
Yeah, I think also, you know, the boat handling, I didn't even mention that, but yet the boat handling does lead to a lot of confidence on the course. You know, when you've pulled off some good moves, maneuvers, you know, that gives you a good frame of mind or a good state of mind to feel confident, and that confidence sort of flows off into the rest of your performance on the race course. So I know it does the opposite as well. You know, when you have a bad move, you know, it's easy to get, you know, strung out about it, and you've sort of got to control alt delete, you know, move on from a costly move where you've done a bad, you made a mistake with your boat handling and done a bad maneuver. So it goes both ways. It boosts your performance on the course if you've got good boat handling across all conditions. And I think what Pete and Blair always pride themselves in is they never take the easy option. And you'll see them coming into the gate. You know, it's easy to say, okay, well, we'll just go right turn because we're already on port, and we'll go around. And it doesn't, they haven't really thought about the fact that actually, if we go left turn with a jibe and a drop, we'll be better set up for the next leg, even if it is 20 knots. You know, so they'll always make the hard move every time.
I remember watching them. I was doing commentary at the 2013 Europeans in Aarhus in Denmark, and they were going around. There was a windward gate there, actually. It was a bit of an experiment that didn't last for that long, but they went round the sort of the traditional starboard bearaway, and there were some boats they wanted to attack ahead of them, and they actually did the usual hoist, but then straight into a jibe set, and pretty much as soon as they completed that jibe, they jibed back again. So they did an S shape of a double jibe, and that put them in an attacking position, so that anyone that was ahead of them was going to be looking over their shoulder, worrying about whether they could actually jibe safely onto port and get across them attacking. I mean, I've never seen anyone do that before or since. I don't know how often they've used that maneuver, but is that something that they would be trying during the kind of training exercises that you put them through?
Exactly. That's exactly it. I mean, I think, you know, you challenge yourself above and beyond all the time in your training, and then you can bring it out, you know, those incredible moves, you can bring them out on the table, and they can become race winning moves, and they can become regatta winning moves. You know, I remember what you're talking about, and I remember another one in Porto, which for sure, you know, gave them five boats. And if you look back on the sort of points leading into that final, it was five critical points, you know, that they won right there with a really clever maneuver into the bottom gate in light air, which, you know, no one else had even thought of. You know, it was kind of a low soaky jibe, which got them into that no man's land in the middle with sort of four boats coming into either gate and going slow. And they managed to wiggle around the outside of one of those groups and sort of put them in a really strong position for the last upwind. So those are the sort of moves that you have to challenge yourself on all the time. And if you take, you know, when it doesn't matter as much, if you always take the hardest approach in your boat handling, you'll end up being able to pull those moves off when it really matters.
Which is, again, one of the messages in the recorded sessions for this week is that if you're not capsizing, if you're not pushing those edges in your training, the whole train hard, fight easy approach, then you're really not maximizing the best out of your training. Now, one of the themes that came across to me very much while we were recording those sessions a few months ago is the value and the power of the squad. And I'm guessing that some people watching this are thinking, how am I going to form the squad that's going to create the environment that's going to be able to, you know, test myself in these boat handling moves? So you've got a very dedicated squad. You've managed to create that even during the COVID times, and maybe even more so because of COVID times. You've got that very tight squad that's operating in New Zealand. And that's going to put Pete Belling and Blair Chook in a very strong position, I think, going into Tokyo in July next year. What advice do you have for those that maybe are struggling to put together those squads? How do you pull together those people to actually find that common purpose?
Yeah, it's a tricky question, and it's not an easy answer. I would say, you know, you've got to
create an environment that's fun and really fulfilling in terms of learning, you know, at all levels. And I'll use Aaron McIntosh as another example, you know, with his group, you know, that learning at all levels means that, you know, you can cross train into other sports and make sure that, you know, that the sailors are having a lot of fun and a lot of learnings within those cross training sports as well. And that all contributes, as you know, in windsurfing, the fitter you are, the better you go. So it's a combination of a lot of things. It's getting the group working together really well and sharing information for a common good. And that's probably then the essence of it, sharing information, you know, for a common good. So you're able to leapfrog off each other's backs when somebody discovers something. It's quite easy not to notice that within the group. And it's very easy, even as the coach, not to see exactly some subtle differences, you know, that people are doing technique wise to get better. You know, it could be that just very, very small things around the rig settings and very small things around, you know, the tuning itself or position in the boat and the tack. And there's a lot of things that contribute to speed. And if you're able to really drill down and into those things in your debrief, you know, sort of go through the day very methodically, I think is a good way to bring those out. Try to encourage everybody to contribute. So you never want to see, if you're starting to see that one team is not really contributing, well, you've got to find a way to bring them into that contributing mode, because it's clear they're either feeling that they've got something to hide, or they're feeling that they're not learning. They're out of place either way, out of whack. So you've got to bring them into the same mode of operandum. And it isn't easy. It requires constant attention, and you need someone to facilitate it. Someone who's good at just bringing out all those little gems of information, the little gold nuggets, we call them, that are always there on the table after every session that you go sailing. Someone's going to have learned something that they can share with everyone else. And it just subtly changes the way people do things, and they might bring some of that on themselves, or they may bring a version of it on and find themselves going better.
Well, and you bring up an interesting point for everyone watching now, because we've got such a diversity of experience and achievement within the group that are following Road to Gold. And I don't want anyone that hasn't won a world championship or an Olympic Olympic gold medal to feel that their contribution or their questions are less valid than anyone else. So I'm hoping that if you've got questions, that you won't hold back, that you will use the chat box. And if you want to come in and actually have a conversation directly with Hamish, also put your hand up. If you were in on our first Q&A a couple of weeks ago, you'll remember the conversation with Veronica. And I may well bring in John Emmett and Lily, who had made a great contribution last week, because I've got some specific questions that I think they might be well qualified to address. But I'm going to dig into Alvaro's questions in the chat box now, and then I'll address the ones that came through on email. So it would be great, says Alvaro, to hear from Hamish how he manages this squad group training all together for good when you have such superstars like Pete and Blair, who will always likely be on top of that group, being the ones that go to represent the country at the games. And so Hamish, you're well aware of that challenge, and I seem to remember that Logan Dunning-Beck, who probably most other nations would happily take as their representative to go to the games with a good chance of winning a medal, he was thinking about throwing in the towel, I believe. And so where is he at, and how do you keep talents like that on board when Burling and Chuuk have already booked the ticket to go to the games?
Yeah, it's a really good question too. I mean, that team were our training partners in Rio, and you know, as you say, Logan's incredibly talented, and you know, he would be, yeah, any country would be happy to have his skills. He's talented in so many ways. He's got, you know, really, really good understanding of the engineering. He's an engineer. He works up at Core Builders, building engineering structures for them, with the with the GP Grand Prix, and he's got so much to offer in so many areas. And he's now teamed up with another young guy who's an incredibly talented sailor, very, very fit, Oscar Gunn, and they've reinvented themselves. Well, as a team, they've reinvented themselves, and they're actually, I think, you know, huge potential together. They've got, you know, much more synergy around their performance as a team. There seems to be, you know, a lot of respect going both ways. There's all the things that we've talked about in Road to Gold sitting really prominent. You know, I often see them changing around and Oscar steering and Logan crewing and just their attitude together as a team. It's got all the hallmarks of a really great team. And I think they've absorbed all that, you know, from Peter and Blair, and they're still learning. And that's one of the reasons why they're still there, is that they are learning so much, and they know that it's going to put them on top of the world as well. And Peter and Blair got there, and they've been very generous in bringing that information to the group, the information that they've learned over their, you know, three Olympic campaigns. So it's anyone that's involved in that group can feel, you know, rewarded by the fact that they're so generous with what they know.
So as long as they're learning, as long as everyone feels that they're making progress, that's the key to keeping them involved, even if they haven't got that golden ticket to the games.
I think that's it, exactly.
Just a little story on that. Eric Heil and Tommy Plussel, who got the bronze medal at Rio 2016 for Germany. They were so grateful to their training partners, Justus Smith and Max Böhm, who also have won the European Championships in their own right, that they were going to cut their bronze medal in half and give half of it to their training partners. But their training partners said, hang on, guys, don't be silly. You can't do that. So what they did was they had it cast. And they had a replica made, and they gave that to their training partners. But that's how much it meant to them, to Eric Schmidt and Tommy Plussel, to have those dedicated training partners that gave everything to helping their teammates win that medal in Rio.
Exactly.
Kevin Kenny, you are one of our greatest contributors, and you always ask fantastic questions. So here's the question from Kevin. Do you have standard debrief questions process at end of practice to find and capture learnings? So if there's a default template, Hamish, that you can throw at any situation, what are those classic questions that you should ask?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's always, what did you learn? You know, it seems so obvious, but it's, you know, the obvious one to actually put on the table is, you know, what did you learn, you know, and what would you, if it's a regatta or a situation, what would you do differently next time? You know, that's a really good sort of one in your face to say, well, okay, well, you know, if you had that opportunity coming into that maneuver, what did you learn from it, and what would you do differently next time? As you know, a couple of really good sort of prying questions. And I think I'm a little reluctant to be, you know, too regimented about things beyond that on a daily basis, because it's so different what you do each day on the water. It depends so much on the conditions and the group and the environment, and whether you're racing or whether you're breaking down the drill, breaking down the maneuvers into drills and doing drills. But generally speaking, I think, you know, you've just got to have the time. It doesn't want to be too long. It doesn't want to be too short. You need the engagement, total engagement from the sailors. You need everybody's concentration. They need to be there with you, and they need to be motivated to learn. So if you've got that going, I think you'll find a shorter time. It wants to be definitely, you know, under an hour. It wants to be more than 30 minutes for your debrief. And it seems you want to spice it up. If you get into the same routine, like with anything, you'll stop. The learning will stop because it becomes too much of a boring routine. So I think mixing it up with some video, maybe some tracking information from the boats, or you bring along a performance analysis for a day if you have that opportunity, bring in somebody new from sail making or whatever, but you just try to mix up things as much as you can in order to continue the learnings.
And you've partially answered one of Alvaro's earlier questions, where he wants to know how much daily training time on the water you think is the best quality practice. And you talk about putting the first hour of your training on the water as your best boat handling time for training on boat handling. When does it drop off a cliff? After how many hours do the learnings start to really diminish?
Yeah, I think in anything that's intense, like maneuvering, starting drills, or any of those that are really intense periods, you're losing. Oh, I think an hour and a half into it, you're starting to lose people. You can go out testing for quite some time. If you're testing equipment, there's possible hours and hours in that, because it's one tack and it's subtleties, but again, there's a limit, and you can fall off the cliff there as well. And I think the key is to shorten up sessions, to bracket time so that people know that it's likely to be this amount of time, so that they're pacing themselves for that bracketed amount of time, rather than just saying, well, we're going out sailing, but for what purpose and how much time is really important to answer those questions. So your pre-brief has got to have really good buy-in from the group. And typically, I'd plant a few seeds the night before about what we might be able to do with the next day, looking at the forecast. And then in the morning before you go out, is really drill down into, what did they think would be really good to do with the day? What you get the best response to anything when you start to get the sailors themselves driving the drill or the exercise for the day. That then is a gem, and that day is going to go well.
So that's a very consultative form of coaching, proper coaching as I would call it, but there still seems to be a lot of coaching in the sailing world that is more of an instructional form. I just wonder, would that approach apply also to coaching junior and youth squads, where they might need more direction and a bit more instruction, or would you still be consultative with them as well?
Well, it does for me. I mean, as we've talked about this, but I've taken three Optimus Worlds teams away, and I've done five or six youth teams away, and that. But you've got to remember that I use the same method across all of them. But you've got to remember they're at the top of their game. So you could actually argue that somebody going to the Opti Wells is probably as skilled across the road to gold as somebody, going to the Olympic Games and potentially winning a gold medal. So it does that relevance across all of those different age brackets. I think where you start to see less relevance is when you're going down more into the learning process, the learning of a new class. Let's say, if you're coming into the fin from a laser, or and there's a whole lot of skills you need to learn for the first time, such as, tuning skills, equipment skills, boat handling skills, a whole lot of fitness skills, where you've got to turn to experts who know exactly how to do those things and learn from them.
Okay,
so then
yeah.
You become an instructor.
Yes, okay, fair enough. But the level that you're operating at with your squads, it tends to be that you're dealing with people that are more self-motivated and that much further along the road to gold. Hamish, I don't know if you need to get your...
Something about the swing around here. The sun is really intruding into the boat at the moment.
I can see some really good questions coming up. I would love for you to come in on the call if you're happy to come in on the call. I see you've got a question about you're trying to train a sort of resistance to pain. If you want to come in on the call directly, it would be great to have you. So I'll just wait a little moment to see if you want to join us.
Can you see me?
I can't see you, but I can hear you. Let's see if we can see you in a moment. Benedict's running the hosting. Let's see if we can bring you in. I see you. So, buon Natale, is that right?
Can see me. Hi.
Something like that. Anyway, happy Christmas in Italian. No, it obviously didn't work. But happy Christmas.
Thanks. To you. buon Natale, yes.
So, Mile.
Yes.
I hope you're having a bit of time to enjoy with the family. Let me just read out your question, or maybe you want to put it directly to Hamish.
Oh, yeah, maybe I can do it by myself, by voice.
Yes, you go.
If you can hear me.
So I can hear you. I think, yes. Yeah, you go.
Yeah, I think that now we have some... we spend a lot of time to try to train with big waves, to try to find some similar Japan conditions. And so, Japan and Sicily is sending it very well. And we have some tough trainings because it's kind of boat handling very difficult. And for the helm, but when we have to manage a situation with waves with a small medium period, so you don't have the time to surf it all the way with the boat, and ideally you don't want to never foil on that kind of wave. You want to keep the boat low and surf it like an old boat. And if that boat starts to foil, you will probably 100% crash, and during this crash you can always control them, and during this crash most of the time the crew finish on the boat and hits the boats very, very hard, and so there is a moment where you can't really do not so much to manage this moment because it depends on the next wave that you're gonna meet, and you don't know what's the deepness of that kind of waves sometimes. And sometimes you hit the boat very hard, and so I'm trying to going back to trapezing and going out on the on trapezing, but sometimes it hurts so much that I have to stop. And I'm trying to learn to say to Vito, like, I'm fine, I can do this, but this I can't. And so we try to keep going always like we are in a race, but sometimes, that you have to avoid like injury. And so I don't really get the limit, the borderline. I try to do like, rugby players. And the fact that Vito is not hurting as much as me, it's also not so, team. Sometimes I would like that he hits the boat like as much as me, And so I'm the only one on the boat, like all the other crews. And it's really difficult to know what's the border, what's the moment when you say, okay, I have to stop, but then you ask yourself, I really have to stop, or I could have done more,
Yeah, wow, that's a really interesting question. So Hamish, I wonder if you can relate this to wave camps that you've done with the New Zealand team. Now, I don't know how much you've done with the NACRA 17s because they are so much more extreme than anything else. But when we've got Mael, who's hurting a lot, and her helm Vittorio is saying, come on, we got to do another training round. When is too much pain? When should you actually stop and say, hang on, we need to recover here?
It reminds me of coaching my daughter, who was a free skier, and having her on the phone, looking for more encouragement as she smashes herself down the mountain, falling and tumbling and hurting herself. But yeah, I mean, it is a fine balance. And I remember saying to my daughter, Anna, that at the time that, if you're Roger Federer and you have a bad day, you can smash your racket and get a fine and walk away, but you'll come back the next day and you won't be injured. Whereas with Anna, if you're having a bad day and you keep crashing,
eventually you're going to have an injury that you won't be able to walk, you know, you won't be able to walk away from. So I think, you know, that's probably the answer. In a way, it's a very, when you're in an extreme sport like that, it's a head game. And if you haven't got your head in the right place, and you're feeling confident, then there are certain days that happens and you're never going to get your head in the right place. And you just have to pull the pin. And there's other days when you feel invincible and you can go out and tackle it and master it and feel, you know, and feel under control. So it is very much a mental skills sort of process that you have to go through. And I think when you have those good days, you need to look quite carefully at what led to those good days in the big waves where you feel invincible and in charge of the boat, and try to bring yourself to those, you know, really write down those key moments in time, how you felt when you went to bed the night before knowing it was going to be rough, and what your thought processes were throughout the morning when you went out to launch, and how did you know, not be intimidated by the first few waves, and what processes were you feeling. You know, it's obviously not defensive, and it's not ruthlessly attacking. It's somewhere in between, where you're comfortable and you know that, yeah, we're going to have some issues, but it's not going to be too bad because I feel vaguely in control. So it's a really good question, but I think it comes down, a boat handling question, but I think it comes down to often to a state of mind when we're in extreme conditions. In these boats, and NACRA is the most extreme of all.
Hamish, just a follow-up question on that. Maybe Mael, if you want to respond either in the chat box or in speech, although it's not a very clear line to you. You do talk about how you and Dave Barnes used to swap around in the boat, how Pete and Blair swap around in the 49er. Would you also recommend that Mael tells Vittorio, well, if you want to have a go at the front, we can swap around and you can see what it feels like from my perspective?
Yeah, I think that's for sure a good, you know, that's the way forward longer term. And I look at the NACRA teams that we have in New Zealand, and we, you know, we were referring to the Tutukaka wave camp, which we do every month through this winter with COVID. And that's, you know, well, the helmsman, Micah, he's been a crew, you know, in the past, so he's quite comfortable in that role. But Erica Dawson, she comes from a helming background. She's now crewing, but I think it's quite, you know, refreshing for them to change around. And then they get a perspective right away of how difficult the two things are. And gauging that perspective allows them to really, A, appreciate how difficult it is, but B, also to maybe find ways to help the other person out when it's, you know, clear that it's extreme where they are, that they you know, when they're in a position that it's really, really hard for them to do anything. And it's, you know, maybe you don't go through the whole process, you know, doing everything you would do at race level, but if you even just have a little taste of it the other way around, I think it's helpful to switch around and then, you know, try to upskill and try to learn and just try to figure out what the best ways are going forward. But I definitely think that the mental approach, really triggering the right mental approach for those windy days, those extreme days, is pretty key.
Mael responds in the chat box, we already do swap around, but with waves like this, we never did. So, sorry, Hamish.
Yeah, where's the trust?
Well, yeah, I mean, that boat requires an awful lot of trust between the two people sailing it together, that's for sure. Mael, I wish you the best with your training, and I hope we see you on many more of these calls. I realise we're running out of time and I want to get as many of these questions done. So I'm going to put Natalie's question. Regarding coaching tools, I struggle to use the video regularly in cadet coaching because it requires a lot of post-processing for debriefing. And during the video recording on the water, I tend to have less time for direct feedback to the sailors. How can I ideally manage a good balance, i.e. real-time coaching and post-coaching using video?
Well, what I do is a good answer to that. I use the video a lot, You know, a good stabilized video like the Osmo Pocket Rocket. They've got, I think there's Osmo Pocket actually, but there's a lot of videos now with good stabilization. And you just, I tend to use it as almost like a recording thing to just capture the day. So a lot of my thoughts, instead of writing them down, I'll just put it into the recording about their technique and about what I'm observing. And I can get quite a lot of video during the day without it really interfering too much with, you know, even if you mount one on your head, on your hat, on your helmet, you know, a GoPro as a coach, and then just leave it going. And what you can do then is just hand the data card to the sailors, and they can just watch it in their own time. So I don't bother with it being part of the debrief. But, you know, I know with Pete and Blair as an example, you know, Pete would, he's so obsessed with getting better. He'd quite happily, you know, finish the debrief and then go off to bed and watch a couple of hours of video from the day and before he goes to sleep. And if he wasn't going to watch video of his own, filming of his own performance, he'd be happily searching YouTube and looking for content to watch, you know, of other people's performance in that class, or, you know, looking to learn by watching, you know, the 23 hours of America's Cup YouTube footage to get an understanding of what the comms about the afterguard is. So, you know, there is many ways to learn, and video is a great tool.
Wow, what an insight you've just given us there to Pete Burling and how he thinks. So that, again, reminds me a lot of the conversations I've had with Nathan Outridge, also a YouTube obsessive. And I see John Emmett nodding there as well. So John Emmett with Lily, also big fans of YouTube. So an awful lot to learn by watching others. A question from Dominic. How important is training aiming at performing boat handling under pressure, e.g. several boats going around the same mark at speed and or already tired and or with wrongly set up equipment, in contrast to perfectly executed manoeuvres? What a great question.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, we are under so much more stress in a racing environment than we are when we're doing it the perfect training. So... That's a great question, and it makes me think. You know, well, we're trying to get the best out of our boat handling, because we do it at the beginning of the day when we're fresh and we know how intense it can be. Then, you know, that offers the right answer there, is to actually throw a session in at the end of the day. You know, a difficult boat handling session to finish the day when you are a bit tired and quite likely the breeze has increased or decreased, and so you're out of setting. So, yeah, there's your answer. I think, you know, do a 15, 20 minute, you know, session right at the end of your training day when you're under the pump because you're tired. You're probably, you know, in the wrong setting and a bit ragged from the day. So, yeah, I think you've got to be able to perform under pressure, and you've got to be able to test yourself. And it's a really good point you've just made.
Right. Still a lot of questions to do. Hamish, how are you doing for time?
Yeah, I'm good. Yep.
All right. Let's keep on going. Now, this is a chapter two question where Alan is asking about the need to eat and drink within 30 minutes of finishing a sailing effort, i.e. don't just wait until dinner that night to fill up. What do you recommend to eat and drink after a hard sailing effort, and how much should be consumed? Should it be an electrolyte solution drink and a banana? We actually did cover some of this in the previous Q&A last week, actually. But anything you want to, sort of anything that jumps out at you there, Hamish?
Yeah, I think it's got to be palatable stuff. I remember Barbara Kendall, you know, she would tell me how nervous she'd get before a regatta. And for her, it was those old, I think they were some kind of bars. They were hideous things, I thought. But they were the thing, you know, in the 90s, they were the thing. And she, that was the only thing she could eat. I mean, she would be so nervous that, you know, she would vomit with her nerves. And she would go, okay, well, this is good, because because I'm vomiting and because I'm nervous, I really care about this. So I'm happy that I'm vomiting because it means that I care about my performance and it means I'm going to go well. So that was her way of overcoming that problem. And I'm bringing that up because what she used to eat with power bars, that's right. And I thought they're the most hideous things I could possibly think of eating. So it's going to be different for everybody. You know, that it's going to be whatever that person, you know, can manage, given that there might be another race and then and they might be in quite a difficult environment, you know, because it's rough, or difficult environment because it's emotionally, there's a lot on, it's the last race and you've got to perform well in order to, you know, finish the regatta with a good result. So it has to be stuff that you're used to eating. And I think with Barbara Kendall, the reason I bring that up is that was what she was used to eating. So you know, with anything, you don't want to introduce something for the first time. It's something that you've kind of gotten used to eating and your stomach's ready for it and your mind's ready for it and you're going to get on with it, but you've just got to be able to eat. You've got to put, you know, energy out, energy in. You got to equal a chart.
I'd also say to Alan, we did an extra session with Dr. Pete Cunningham and we had Saskia Clark, the 470 Olympic champion, jump in on that call as well. And Saskia said that she tried all kinds of scientific this, that, and the other electrolyte drinks. And in the end, they ended up going to Marks and Spencer, a supermarket in the UK, and buying these high calorie milkshakes that made no claims about being electrolytic or scientific or anything else. It was just get as many calories in as you possibly can. They just were burning up so many calories sailing the 470. And I can't imagine, I mean, if that's what you're doing at 470, what are you doing in some of the other Olympic classes as well? You know, so don't be too, well, Saskia's message was don't be too fussy or scientific about what you use. And Pete Cunningham, the physiology expert, totally backed her up on that, said, you know, you don't have to be too precise about buying something with long words on the container. Just get something that piles the calories in.
Yeah, exactly. And make sure it's legal.
Well, there's that too. Yes, of course. I'm going to keep on piling through these questions. We've got one from Silke, and this is more about the boat maintenance aspect of chapter three. So about the equipment list. So when you're running your equipment, how often do you update it? Is it an everyday task that you log how many hours you've put into those sails or that mast? And what kind of system are you running for tracking the sailing hours on your equipment?
Yeah, I think it's definitely, you've got to have some kind of spreadsheet where you log hours on everything, so you know how long before you need to change it. But on the general maintenance side of things, it's really important if you haven't got a coach, the ideal way would be just like as things, you know, crop up during the day, that you get them noted down. If you don't have a coach, you can write them on the wet notes, then, you know, take some wet notes with you and make sure you write it down, because it's amazing how many times you can go out and find a few little niggles in your boat here and there. And you think you'll remember when you get ashore and you don't, and you go out and the next conditions replicates itself another, you know, 3 weeks down the track and you've gone, oh, that's right, I remember I needed to fix that, you know. So it's simple things, but, you know, you've got to have the boat perfect. And it's one of those things like boat handling. It's an easy one on the table. You might as well have it. And it's amazing how many races are lost with poor equipment maintenance or even just poor equipment.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Another question from Dominic, and I see that one from you as well, Nuno. I'll try and get onto that in a moment. From Dominic, would worse manoeuvres at the end of a training session, as I understood Hamish, not lead to some bad muscle memory overnight? So are you grooving in bad memories, Hamish, if you're training too long in the day?
Yeah, I think that there's a real, for me as a coach, I'm always on the side of less is best, you know. So I would be, you know, it's very hard if you're a group, because, you know, less for somebody is going to be more for someone else and so on. And each team is quite different. And so you need to manage that a little bit. And it's not a bad thing to, you know, to suggest to somebody who clearly is fitting in that area of less is better for them. You can see that fatiguing. To suggest that they go in, because it quite often, you know, humans as we are, there'll be a lot of resistance to them wanting to miss out, go in and miss out. But I would, you know, I'd be saying, well, look, you're clearly not performing as you should right here. You're getting raggedy around the edges. You know, going in is the right answer for them. And then there may be some resistance and pushback, but then you talk about that in there and you go, well, why are you feeling like this compared to the rest of the group? And it'll become pretty clear that they're just not as fit, not as strong, not as mentally resilient. So it brings to the table the things that you'd really want them to get on with anyway. So often, you know, stating the obvious, like, you know, you're looking pretty shagged, you want to head on in, is a good way to sort of bring about change in other areas. But everybody has good days and bad days, no matter how fit they are. And I think it's important to monitor how you're feeling on any day. And we've often used, you know, I don't think it matters about being male or female, but I think it's a really helpful thing on, I've found when I'm coaching female sailors as well, to put a score on how you're feeling that day. Let's say if, you know, you're feeling invincible, it's a 5 out of 5, or you're feeling pretty shit, it's a 1 out of 5. And we tend to do that ourselves, score ourselves, and including the coach, you know, because you're not going to be perfect every day either. And it's quite good for everybody just to know, how are you feeling that day? Because then you can understand, well, what kind of training do you really want to do here? If everybody's feeling like a 3 out of 5, well, that's not a great day for, you know, an intense bone handling session. If you're all feeling invincible, 5 out of 5, well, that could be a great day to take on something new and challenging.
Yeah, what a great observation. I wonder how honest you can get everyone to be, but I know that's one of the things that you push hard on Road to Gold, and the squad mentality is having that trust in each other to be able to be that honest with each other.
Yeah, and there's a lot going on in people's back, you know, behind the scenes, and it quite often physically doesn't show up or manifest itself. But if they've got, you know, 10 balls in the air because they're trying to sell their house or change their jobs, or, you know, it's worth, people don't want to tell you all about those personal details, but they're quite happy to give you a score, which will tell you, well, there's a lot going on in this person behind the scenes in this person's life that needs to, you know, you need to be aware of.
I mentioned Kevin Kenny earlier. He always asks so many great questions. I'm not going to have time to ask them all, I'm afraid, Kevin. He's up to 27 pages of notes as he goes through the first three chapters of Road to Gold. And he says he knows that this seems a lot, but the process has caused him to rethink what is being conveyed and to restructure the notes, triggering aha connections. And that's a process that he learned in law school. So I wonder if Kevin's writing version 2 of Road to Gold for us. But he's got another question, which is, he says, maybe too early, but I wonder if it is. It's one of the primary reasons that Kevin signed up for Road to Gold. But basically, in our teaser about boat speed at the end of chapter 3, we mention that you record notes by day, by event, you index them, and then you whittle them down to a cheat sheet. Now, he's been creating similar lists over the years, letting each boat and each race help refine those general checklists. So he's after a sample of this cheat sheet, and what is your method of creating these cheat sheets? So I'm wondering, at some point, can we get a sample of that cheat sheet? And maybe you can't do that right now, but what's your method for creating those cheat sheets?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I'm doing one for the America's Cup at the moment. It's just from a couple of months of observing the team and realizing, you know, what are the important, factors in performance. And it's going to be different for each team. I mean, the America's Cup, they've got 11 on board. They've got, you know, six of them are grinders. And, you know, their requirements are quite different to the other five who are sort of sailing the boat. And you know, so your performance cheat sheet is going to be quite different in the America's Cup class than it is going to be in a laser and it's going to be in another thing. But, you know, it's important just to observe and figure out what are the key headings, if you like, or factors that go into a good performance. And then, and they'll be different across the win range. So it's always like we always bring it down to the win range with Road to Gold. It's really important, you know, what are the key factors in light air for performance in your class, and what are the key factors in medium air, and what are the key factors in strong winds. And you may want to bring in sea state as well if you feel that you want to refine it further. And once you get those headings, and then, you know, you create this little you know, sort of list that you want to go through before you hit the water. And and we've also talked, you know, we'll talk later about, you know, the playbook in terms of the weather, the strategy playbook, and that'll fit in there as well as one of the headings. But there's a whole lot of other things that you need to remember in order to perform on the day. And it's the sailors that are, they've got the ability to know what the priorities are on the day, you know, with that can consistently win across the wind range. And they don't get that for free. They'll have their performance cheat sheet. If they're smart enough, it might just be in their head and they can keep it all in one place. But for most of us mere mortals, it's written down, and it's an invaluable tool.
This is an area where I'd love to bring John, Emma and Lily in, but we don't have time for that. But I hope you guys are going to stay with us for future Q&As like this. What you mentioning about most of us aren't smart enough to keep that stuff in our head, Hamish, and keeping things simple. It just reminds me of this theory that we only have so much sort of decision making processing power in our brains. And it was the reason, for example, why Steve Jobs only had black polo necks and the same, you know, six pairs of jeans and whatever else. He had no choices to make about what clothes to wear in the morning. I understand that Mark Zuckerberg, owner of Facebook, is the same, that if you don't have to make choices about your clothing, it leaves your mind clearer to make the big decisions about the day, about the next Apple product or the next innovation in Facebook. And so even though you think you know all the maneuvers or all the sort of the micro movements involved in jibing a 49er, if you've got something, it's your first windy day for months, let's say, after a light air period, if you can refer to that cheat sheet, is that what it's about? It's just minimizing the sort of the drag on your processing?
Exactly. You know, you've got so many things going on in sailing. I think it's one of the most complex because it's very equipment orientated. And because you're racing the conditions as well as the opposition, you know, you've got three dimensions, very unlike any other sport. It's incredibly complicated, and getting the priorities right in terms of where you should focus your attention on any given day is absolutely key. And without, you know, the processes that will bring you to that, to, you know, the obvious priorities, then it's likely your brain power could be actually, like you say, you know, being wasted with, you know, what to wear. And what to wear is an incredibly important decision in sailing, and it's one of the things you definitely need to consider in your cheat sheet, because you can spend a hell of a lot of time procrastinating about, you know, whether you should have your super warm wetsuit on or your light wetsuit on. And, you know, and you just got to eliminate those simple things as well. Or just take both, chuck the others on the coach boat, so you're not going to worry about it. But, you know, getting into the right clothes, and for a sailor, I've always been quite amused that even at the highest level, it's still an important consideration.
We've got so many more questions. I see a good one from Nuno about watching. How often do you watch tracking analysis of other boats so that you understand them better? I think that's a great question to bring in for a future session, because one of the things I've learned from studying day types with you, Hamish, it's just reminded me of how even at the very highest level, sailors have set moves that they trot out for all occasions. It's like, sometimes it's a square peg for a square hole, but sometimes they're trying to make that square peg fit in a round hole. I think we can address Nuno's question a bit further down Road to Gold when we talk about day types. So I'm going to wrap it up there. Hamish, just so I know for my own sake as well, how long are you out of radio range now? When's the next time I get to talk to you?
Well, we've got you'll probably have another 2 hours as we disappear over the horizon to Great Barrier. We can have a yarn, and then we're back on Sunday. So we'll be ready to go for the next Q&A in a week's time.
Right, awesome. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us on for us in Europe and the Americas. It's still Boxing Day, so we're still very much recovering from Christmas. And for you, Hamish, on the 27th of December, I hope we haven't made you miss the best mooring spots wherever the rest of the cruising fleet has already disappeared over the horizon. But anyway, you better pull up anchor and get going to where you're going. Great session. Thanks for fantastic questions. And we look forward to seeing you all again this time next week. And we'll find out where Hamish is then.
Awesome. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for your thoughts. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Happy New Year when it comes.
Absolutely. You're right. Happy New Year, because it will be 2021 the next time we talk. All right.
Yeah. Good on.
Thanks very much, guys. Bye for now.
Cheers.